able to talk a little bit about his experiences. Dr. Dolling is a former diplomat, political staffer and senior public servant, served as national affairs correspondent for the Canberra Times from 2008 to 2010, and is now a contributing correspondent with The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Three times a Melbourne Press Club Quill Award winner, Dr. Dolling has written extensively on foreign policy, national security and intelligence issues, including reports that led to the resignation of the former Defence Minister, Joel Fitzgibbon. He obtained exclusive access to the WikiLeaks US embassy cables relating to Australia, and as I waved around earlier, is the lead story in today's Sydney Morning Herald in relation to the Stratfor releases and the sealed indictment of Julian Assange. He has extensive experience of FOI laws and processes both as an applicant and a decision maker, so that is indeed a very useful perspective. Hello and welcome.
Just as I was walking across the very wet and windswept car park sitting, I was reminded how fragile information could be because I dropped my notebook in a puddle and drenched all of my notes for my talk, which had been consigned to the bin. But perhaps they weren't that insightful anyway. So I might try and follow the track I was going to take, but I'll probably improvise as I go. How long have I got to talk? Yeah, and we'll have questions. As Cassie indicated, I've had a somewhat varied career. I'm a journalist these days, but I'm a newcomer to the business. I've only been doing journalism since 2008. And prior to that, I'd been all sorts of things, basically. But the odd thing is that through most of my career, questions of access to information, freedom of information, archives, leaks, police investigations and the like seem to have been sort of a continuing theme in my somewhat wayward career path. So I thought, to sort of illustrate my perspective on these things, I might do it slightly biographically, basically. About 20 years ago, I started out, having been a very junior academic, to join the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Came to Canberra, and I did so as an historian. I had a background in history, in an archival research, and indeed history remains my great love. There's nothing I actually like better, apart from being with my family, to take myself off to the National Archives in Canberra, sit down on a quiet afternoon where it's immensely peaceful, and open up some dusty old mouldering files and find secrets from long ago. Curiosity killed the cat, and I'm a sucker for that. So I got offered a job with Foreign Affairs to rummage around in their archive, and they paid me good money to do so, and I did that for several years. And having sort of free range of a Foreign Service's secrets over the last 50-odd years was an eye-opener, even for someone who'd been poking around history for a while. And at a very early stage, it sort of brought home to me the huge gap between public knowledge of the business of government broadly and perhaps diplomacy and intelligence and foreign policy in particular, and the realities behind the scene, and that so often what might appear in your public statements by ministers and elected officials is but the tip of the iceberg, and that there's a vast amount of activity, some of it highly significant with very considerable consequences, that year in, year out, just goes, washes past, that the electorate and the community at large are quite unaware of. So early in my career, I sort of got an introduction, if you like, to the secret world, both in a historical sense, but then I moved into the business of diplomacy and was at least briefly a practitioner in the area. I then got another insight a few years later when I worked up at Parliament House in Canberra, as advisor to Laurie Brereton, the Shadow Minister for Foreign Affairs, and I was in that role for about 5.5 years. And that was another eye-opener because it introduced me to the secret world of politics, which was another quite different world, conducted by often different rules, but also once again characterised by the fact that the public, by and large, only saw 10% above the waterline and missed so often the real mechanisms and reasons for decision-making. And in some cases, those reasons are, in the political realm, are less less easily transparent and less accountable than the actions of bureaucrats, which can be subject to FOI or eventual archival release or the like. So that too was an eye-opener as an appreciation, again, of just how much is off the radar in our day-to-day political life. It's unusual in this past week that the lid has been lifted, at least on the Labor government side. And I must admit, having worked for the Labor Party for a number of years, I found very few of the observations and comments made by folk in the last week at all revelatory. But for the broad public and for you know the vast majority of people in a democratic system, this was sort of shock horror stuff, and then everyone suddenly pulled the curtains back and said, oh, it's all okay now, we'll just move on. Nothing happened here. While I was working for Laurie Breton in the foreign policy advisory role, I also saw some examples of the power of information if it's released against the wishes of policymakers. And probably the most significant incidents involved in that related to events concerning East Timor in the mid-90s. And to cut a long story short, in the events leading up to East Timor's independence in 1999, the Australian government played something of a double game. While publicly professing some support for a process of self-determination, privately they were very keen for East Timor to remain part of Indonesia. The prevailing view, as it had been for the previous 30-odd years, was that East Timor, an independent East Timor, would be an inconvenience, a problem in relations with Jakarta. And the then Howard government sought to sort of square the circle between public expectations, the realities of its preferences, and also the realities on the ground where the Indonesian military were orchestrating violence in East Timor and militias and the like. Basically, ministers, and particularly the foreign minister, Mr. Downer, and Mr. Howard, the Prime Minister, squared the circle by lying and by obfuscation and evasion. And in particular, the Foreign Minister declared that there really wasn't a big problem there. There were just some rogue elements causing some trouble. The Indonesian military could be relied to safeguard the balance in East Timor. Now, it happened that there was a series of leaks from deep within the Australian diplomatic and intelligence community of highly classified documents that revealed the truth of the government's knowledge, that the government was aware what the Indonesian military were doing, also revealed that the then government was not merely reluctant to support the idea of sending peacekeepers into East Timor, but actually was out there arguing against it in discussions with the United States and other countries, quite at odds with their public position. And there were a whole series of leaks that had, I think in retrospect, a significant impact on forcing the government's hand and also reinforcing public opinion in its support for the East Timorese process of self-determination and independence. So I think that the leaks that took place, which were of a very highly classified nature, more, although not in volume as large as things that have come through WikiLeaks in the last year, they were leaks that that went to, or was the classifications were top secret and so-called code word material, signals intelligence, and very highly classified material. But it did have an impact on government policy. And you had a case where a government had been doing something essentially in secret, a whistleblower or whistleblowers revealed a whole lot of information, and it had an impact on policy. And it illustrated to me at the time that revelations of material, uncontrolled revelations of material, could have a very significant impact. Those events also showed to me that governments hate that, absolutely hate that, and can be determined to spend very large sums of money and inordinate amounts of time pursuing those who have broken ranks, who have split from the program, and indeed who may well have breached the law in terms of making their own unilateral decisions about what should be public and what should not be public. In the case of those particular instances, the largest leak investigation the Australian government's ever run, and ran for nearly 2 years, cost about $1.5 million, and eventually brought the federal police to my doorstep one morning as they were seeking what they thought was a treasure trove of highly classified documents that were somewhere in my house. But they went away empty-handed, so I guess they must have ill-advised the Canberra magistrate, whom they said that you should sign off this warrant and find all these things. But it did illustrate that whistleblowers can have an impact. The if you like, unauthorised release of information can have a very significant impact, and that governments are exceptionally determined to put a stop to that, both on the grounds that it causes trouble, it causes inconvenience, political problems, and also, fundamentally, because it's against the law and it involves people, individuals, taking matters into their own hands. And we might all applaud leakers and whistleblowers, depending on the terminology itself tells you where you're standing, on the basis of what they leak. And we might, well, look at something and your own politics might say, oh, that's excellent. You know, that's really going to help on that. But sometimes people leak stuff for all sorts of reasons. And my experience over the years as political staffer and as journalist tells me their motivations are as varied as anything in human or social interaction. Some are high-minded and principled. Some have done it because they hated their boss. And I can say the best leak I was involved with while I worked for the Labor opposition was the one involving travel routes. Laurie Oakes had a spectacular leak, which I can say was facilitated by Brayden's office, which went to the fact that John Sharp, the Transport Minister, had year in, year out been routing his travel allowances. Every week of Parliament had been taking an extra $300 or so and putting it in his pocket. And a person stepped forward and revealed the paperwork on this and showed that he'd actually been caught out, but he'd secretly paid back some of the money and had been covered up by the government. And Laurie Oakes got a big hit, and it was a bit like an exocet going into the government at the time, because John Sharp resigned and the Minister of Administrative Services resigned. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff resigned. The whole Department of Administrative Services was abolished. The Secretary and Deputy Secretaries all lost their jobs, and it was, you know, bodies everywhere. The funny thing was that although the source was actually quite high-minded, they also did it because they hated their boss, and they really hoped that they'd take that person out through all the damage that was caused. And the funny thing was that when all the rubble settled and the dust blew away, their boss was still standing and went on through a long public service career of, you know, what, nearly 15, they get on to us 20 years later. And is now a deputy secretary. Did quite well. So a sense of, yeah, literally blew everything down. But motivations are interesting because they're highly varied. An example of a couple of years ago, WikiLeaks published the membership list of the British Nationalist Party, the BNP, a right-wing, anti-Muslim, anti-Asian fascist party, basically, but one that competes democratically in elections, has people elected to local council in the UK, the European Parliament, and, you know, is a registered legitimate political party. Depending on your perspectives, you may or may not like it. But it was an interesting question about the public interest arguments for publishing their membership list and for that private information. And well, it'd be an interesting question about what people's views would be, for example, whether or not the membership list of the Labor Party should be published, or the Liberal Party. So it's often, you know, the motivations of people who are involved in the unauthorised disclosure of information or leaking or acquiring it and publishing it and what the information is always significant and can't be forgotten. And my own career has taken me on other angles of this. After I worked for the Labor opposition for a few years, and having been set upon by Australian Federal Police, I was quite unemployable in Canberra, and I eventually decided to leave the service of the Labor Party and do something different, but I could not get a job for love or money, and eventually I had to go all the way to Tasmania, where the only place that would employ me was the Premier's Department down there, where I moved back into the world of secrets, of cabinet government and cabinet secrecy, and I was working on a range of issues, but security issues and things. So suddenly I was back in the secret world, so to speak, having been an outsider. And I then came back to the ACT, and for a number of years I was the director of the Cabinet Office in the ACT government. The ACT is self-government, has a small five-minister cabinet, Every Monday I'd come along to the cabinet meeting, having organised the agenda and the submissions and so forth, and the ministers would come, and I would sit there as the director of the cabinet office and take the cabinet notes, which had remained secret for 30 years, do the cabinet decisions afterwards, get those signed off. I was also a senior FOI decision maker in that period, and I ended up having, as an historian under the Archives Act and also under FOI, having for the previous 15 years been an FOI and archives applicant, and having pursued matters to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, arguing for exemptions and redactions to be turned over. There I was, back in the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, arguing for things to be kept secret and for cabinet secrecy to be preserved and for things to be withheld, which was an interesting exercise to be interrogated by barristers as to my justifications for withholding information. I must say I didn't lose on a single word, but it was an interesting exercise. It was also in that period as a custodian of cabinet secrecy that we had some leaks, and we had to call in the police. And I had to brief up the federal police to go and hunt down the leakers. And I did my research. I looked at the article in the Canberra Times, and we looked at the cabinet papers, and we worked out that it wasn't the final draft cabinet submission. It was a draft that had been leaked because we could look at the text, and then we looked at the distribution of who had access to it. And then we reflected upon a particular individual who'd just been had his contract terminated and was probably quite disgruntled. So we said the cobbers, well, you know, there's a lot of range of suspects there, but this fellow is probably the one you need to go for. So the coppers dutifully turned up and knocked on his door and looking for secrets. So I had been on all perspectives of this. And that was in, 2007-08. And the following year, I became bored with public service and through happen chance was then lured into journalism to work for the Canberra Times. And I think in about week two of my journalistic career, I had quite a nice little scoop about a story about the Defence Intelligence Organisation, Australia's military intelligence organisation. And about 3 months later, that resulted in a second visit by the Australian Federal Police on my door, once again looking for the source of a leak. On both occasions, the observations I'd make is, one, if someone knocks on your door early in the morning at about 5:45, probably trouble. So it's probably a good idea to wake up early. They don't tear your house apart. They just search through it quite meticulously. So if you have a large library of research material and books, you'll find that at the end of the day, after they've been there for about 6 to 8 hours, everything will still be in neat piles, but everything will be in reverse order. It's like your house has been in a blender. An unpleasant exercise. My other whimsical observations on that would be, in retrospect, not that I took avail myself of the opportunity, if you do have to hide anything, put it in the cat litter tray. They don't seem to go there. And they're usually pretty thorough, but on both occasions they curiously omitted to search my briefcase, which is inexplicable. But there you go. But anyway, having turned over the coppers a second time, it's led me to reflect a bit at length about these issues and about access to information. I suppose there's the balance of observations I'd probably make. I should also reflect, subsequently in journalism I've gone on, I've done a few other things. I have been fortunate to have developed an association with WikiLeaks. I've been the beneficiary of some of their material, particularly the Cablegate material on the US cables, and more recently the Stratfor material. I might say something briefly about Stratfor in a sec. All these things have got this balance involved, and I've sat on both sides of the fence. I'm not a believer in total transparency. I don't think that's a world we'd particularly wish to live in. Either on a personal level, nor do I see it as functional for governments and large organisations. And it's an interesting question. I'm a great believer in freedom of information, and in the last couple of years we've had some modest step forwards in FOI in this country, both at a federal level and states and territories, under the reforms to the FOI Act. And on balance, although they haven't gone anywhere near as far as I'd like, they're a force for good in improving transparency for government, although only slightly. But it's interesting what happens when you enhance transparency. For example, cabinet in the cabinet process, and we have Westminster cabinet-style government in this country, the confidentiality of the cabinet is a key thing, that ministers will be able to sit down around the table, talk frankly to each other, arrive at their decisions, but what goes on inside the cabinet room stays secret, or at least secret for a very long time. There was a time when it would always stay secret, then we had a 50-year rule, we'll eventually get to a 30-year rule federally there's two things. There's cabinet minutes, which are the formal records of decisions, then you have the scribbled notes of the cabinet note takers that are used to draft those. Progressively, as things have opened up, you can see that decision making can shift to other places. And indeed, I've seen examples of this. There have been some departures from cabinet secrecy. In the ACT, there's only a 10-year rule. Cabinet papers released after 10 years in the ACT. Sure, it's a little government, sort of state and local government mixed in together, but it still makes significant decisions. It's a 10-year rule. So you now in recent times, we've had ministers in the ACT government who were ministers when decisions that are now being released are being released. But in the ACT, they've even gone further, and indeed in one other jurisdiction in Wales in the United Kingdom, they're now actually publishing, in the interests of open government, summaries of cabinet decisions on the web within a matter of weeks, maybe 2-3 weeks of actual decisions being taken. And you can applaud this, and I think it's a good thing in the sense that it shows you what government is doing, what the highest levels of government, sort of broad decisions. It's not all the detail, but the broad decisions have been taken. But of course, what happens then is that the decision-making goes elsewhere. The decision-making, once the cabinet ministers realise that the room in which they were talking confidentially is no longer absolutely confidential, they step away from that process and make their decisions in another room where the public servants and others are not present, and then the decisions get pushed through the formalities of the process. And indeed, I think it's the nature of government, it's the nature of private institutions, it's the nature of individuals. There's a desire for space in which to make decisions privately, and I can actually see there is an intrinsic good. Most people have an intrinsic value of privacy to some degree, although I think it's less so in recent times. But there's always a balance involved here. Now, my perspectives as a journalist and as an historian, as a public servant also, have been that greater openness in a broad sense is good. And I can see that in a broad sense, in the disclosures that WikiLeaks has made, notably the Cablegate release. Has it changed the world? No, not really. Has it given a lot of people a more informed sense about how the world works, about how governments, and in the case of the United States, how it conducts its diplomacy, how it conducts its relations, indeed how many governments the US interacts with? Does it give people a better sense of that? I think it does. Is that a good thing? I think it is. Greater openness in an authorised way, if you like, through FOI is a good thing. And also the risk of openness that comes from whistleblowers and leakers is something that is also a good thing, you know, in a broad sense. Decision makers then have the possibility, if they think their security is not 100%, if they think there's a risk that something that they're doing will be held up to public scrutiny, just maybe, I think it's a useful check. It's that risk element. I think I'm not in criminology, but I have read that certainly there's sort of theories about preventing criminal behaviour. The risk of being caught is a greater deterrent than actual penalties. And it comes, I think, with the nature of decision-making in institutions, that it's not that people think that they know that what they're doing will be exposed, because if they know that, they'll go and do it somewhere else. But if they think there's a risk, it's a moderating impact. And by and large, in environments where you don't have public scrutiny of any dimension, is where you're most likely to get corrupt, ill-considered, basically bad behaviour from badly motivated individuals who think that they can get away with it because no one's looking. It's one of the reasons why I have a fundamental objection in this country that our intelligence agencies are exempted from the FOI Act, completely exempted. no appeals, no buts. At least in the United States, you can actually go to the CIA and actually apply for stuff, and you might even get a few snippets. Maybe not much, but something. In this country, absolutely blanket exemption. So my overall perspective is, you know, is that the more knowledge is a good thing. Transparency, measures that enhance transparency. Sometimes there might only be small steps, but nonetheless, in recent times, we've had some modest progress. And the thing that I'll probably wrap up with, which is sort of after this bit of a wayward biographical tour, is sort of the things that I've been involved in over the years in terms of FOI, digging stuff out of archives, the whole business of sort of things that are in the secret domain coming into the public domain. It strikes me in the last couple of years, in part thanks to WikiLeaks, in part thanks to sort of to the campaign for FOI reform in this country that was in part run by media but also by quite a few academics and activists, and a growing sense among a lot of people, at least who are politically engaged, that access to information is important as a key part of pursuing, you know, the agendas of be it a, you know, an environmental NGO or a community group. Often when people are increasingly confronted by problems with government, one of the things they'll do is let's do an FOI on that and dig out what are the real reasons for the decisions that have been taken. And that I find that these sorts of issues and the whole question of openness of government and also more particularly indeed openness of private institutions and business, either by accident or by leaking or hacking or whatever, that this sort of broad cluster of issues is up so prominently in public debate in a way that I haven't seen in 20-25 years. I must admit, I think that's a profound thing for the good, just where it all lead. It's not without its cost. I've touched upon those. I mean, for the good that may have come from the WikiLeaks revelations, there's a fellow sitting in a jail cell in the United States who's alleged to have some responsibility for that. If that were to be the case, but illustrates that for whistleblowers and like, the risks are very considerable and the costs. If people decide to take matters into their own hands, which is what's involved with whistleblowers or leakers, however you want to characterise them, the costs can be quite important because the underlying thing is that information's about power and control of information and access to it is you know, one of the fundamentals in how political systems work. So therefore, while there's a great interest and greater openness, there's also some very heavy forces that have a very strong vested interest in going the other way and pursuing those who might reveal things or clamping down on processes that people might use to extract information. And on that, I'll leave you with one anecdote that comes from something I was doing only the other week. Under the new FOI procedures that have been gone through the federal parliament, you don't have to pay an upfront fee for FOI anymore, which is a good thing. And there's an information commissioner that things can be to review things, streamline process in theory that will improve things. And some of these things are good. But about, a year ago, I put in an application to the Department of Foreign Affairs for various diplomatic cables relating to WikiLeaks. And the first period is that you get a response within 30 days. And they came back to me after 30 days saying, we need another 30 days. So I'm quite agreeable. I said, I'm a former FOI decision maker. I understand these things take time. Another 30 days, that's fine. Then they came back and said, oh, it's very difficult. We've got to consult with various other agencies. Need another 30 days. So we went through that. Then they came back and said, oh, sorry, it's going to take much longer. We're going to apply to the Information Commissioner for more time and we're going to charge you $5,000 for access to the information. I then, of course, said, but you can appeal on public interest grounds to have that fee waived. So, of course, being a journalist, I wrote a long, carefully constructed letter that said it's public interest to put this out. They then waited the mandatory 30 days and then replied on the 30th day to say no. I then applied for an internal review. They then waited another 30 days and then said no. I then had to go off to the Information Commissioner. The Information Commissioner is overwhelmed with applications. There is a huge backlog that was then considerable. And now I think it's running to about 4 months before you get a response from the Information Commission of whether or not they're going to consider your issue. At any rate, that went to the Information Commission. They argued that out. They eventually dropped the fees down to about $800, which is a fair drop. They then said they needed more time. The Information Commissioner reluctantly gave them more time. They then ran over that deadline. They then wrote to me and said, we've run over the deadline, so we're not going to charge you the $800, but we still need more time. And then eventually, I think it was about 10 months after the original application, they coughed up a large amount of material, I think 2,000 folios. Of course, there was a lot of black, a lot of big excised out parts. But still, there was some useful information. I got quite a useful story which showed that the government had a good knowledge that Julian Assange was the subject of a very substantial criminal investigation in the United States, and that there was most likely a secret grand jury process going on in the United States to pursue him. But the Australian government had asked about that, but the Americans said, we won't tell you. And the foreign minister then, Mr Rudd, phrased an answer in Parliament that said that he got no formal advice that he was being pursued, because it leaves over other possibilities. And then in the last week, we find that he's the director of Stratfor, who's probably got reasonably good contacts with the Justice Department and the State Department, as the ex-deputy director of diplomatic security for the State Department. Oh, no, secret indictment. We hope to bang him away for so many years. All this little episode shows that governments are extremely reluctant to release information that's got any embarrassment or difficulty, extremely quick to come down hard on those that might cause them trouble. But on the other hand, there's a reasonable amount of progress that's been made, maybe a bit more in the future. But at that, I've taken up an inordinately long time, but we're happy to take questions after the third speaker. Thank you.